The views in this podcast are those of the contributors and don't necessarily represent those of CISL, the University of Cambridge, or Investec, and should not be taken as advice or a recommendation. Welcome to What Next? Leadership Conversations for a Better Future from the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership in partnership with Investec. This series is hosted by Lindsay Hooper and Mark Kahn.
Hello and welcome to What Next? Leadership Conversations for a Better Future, where we explore how leaders can help build future-fit economies. I'm Lindsay Hooper, Chief Executive at the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership.
And I'm Mark Kahn, Chief Strategy and Sustainability Officer at Investec. Together, we'll bring fresh perspectives, provocative questions, and conversations with leaders who are shaping the future of markets, business, and society.
Welcome to this episode. The US is now the central fault line in global sustainability. It's got the world's most advanced innovation ecosystem, the deepest pools of private capital, and some of the fastest scaling clean tech markets. But at the same time, federal and state governments have taken steps that significantly slow or restrict climate and sustainability measures, rolling back regulation, limiting reporting requirements, and reducing public investment. And these shifts are unfolding alongside a sharp anti-ESG backlash in the markets, a profound political realignment, and a new era of geoeconomic competition where climate security and industrial strategy are inseparable. So to understand this moment, we're going to be exploring how did we get here, how much does it matter, and what are the prospects for rebuilding political consensus. And to explore this, we're joined by two people whose work illuminates the landscape from different angles. We're joined by Julian Tett, who's the Provost of King's College here in Cambridge. She's an influential, award-winning journalist at the Financial Times, an anthropologist and author, and one of the clearest interpreters of the emerging age of geoeconomics. And we're also joined by Bob Eccles. Bob has a distinguished academic career. He's now a visiting professor at the Said Business School in Oxford, a leading thinker on corporate purpose and the role of capital markets in shaping long-term value. And his work has focused on how to rebuild political consensus on sustainability.
Gillian and Bob, thanks very much for joining us. We'd like to begin with getting a personal view on your experience and your perspective on the topic. So if you could just give us a sense of how you came to the lens that you have and where you stand in the world today on this topic.
Well, I did a PhD in cultural anthropology before I became a journalist, which taught me to be fascinated by how social systems work, and in particular, look not just at what we talk about, but also what we don't talk about. And I then became a journalist and spent years of my life trying to apply that to my craft. And then around 2018, 2019, I was running the FT in America and noticed that in all the noise about Donald Trump at the time, I was getting a lot of emails from people about this new thing called ESG, environmental social governance issues. So I started digging into why and how that was and became fascinated by the fact that investors and companies in the middle of the last decade began to recognize that ignoring issues around sustainability and supply chains was potentially laying them open to all kinds of risks. So I became very interested in looking at the question of sustainability as a form of risk management.
That's interesting. I have a PhD in sociology. So if you look at the two of us, so it's an anthropologist and a sociologist, coming into this with a very different lens, I think, than you get from an economist or a lawyer, or looking at it through more of a social lens, as Gillian described, and how systems work. I've been really interested in reporting on sustainability before it was called ESG. I was the founding chairman of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board. I was very involved in starting the International Integrated Reporting Council. And the arc of it was for a long time, I mean, that UN report came out, Who Cares Wins, ESG was used for the first time, that was, I don't know, 20 years ago or something. Then empirical work was done to do what Gillian talked about, to show that if you're paying attention to the material issues, and they vary by sector, it's good risk management, it's good for financial performance. And then it got politicized on both the left and the right. and I wrote a piece about this called The Topology of Hate for ESG. People on the far left, who I call the sustainability Taliban, they didn't like ESG because it wasn't making the world a better place, right? It was just focused from their point of view on value creation, which is the point of view we had at SASB. And then people on the right gave it a particular definition that it was this kind of woke progressive agenda. So they didn't like it for different reasons, although they were defining it as something different than it really was intended to be from SASB. So I called them the sustainability flat earthers. And then what you've seen is this kind of debate, which isn't really grounded, I think, in a lot of reason. And 4 years ago or so, I wrote a little piece called Grift Capitalism, the GOP's brilliant strategy for ripping off ordinary Americans. And I got an email from a good friend of mine named Dan Crowley, who's a Republican I've known for 20 years. He said, Bob, I read your piece and I was a little disappointed it's beneath you. And we talked about it. And I said, you know, this is really kind of silly. Between the far right and the far left, there's everybody else that's trying to get on with their lives, manage companies, be investors. So we started our GOP outreach campaign. And then another Republican friend of mine, Tim Doyle, we started the Responsible Business Coalition or Initiative. And so for the past couple of years, I've been spending a lot of time with Republicans, and particularly on the climate side, we can talk about an eco-right. And it's really interesting because I've met with politicians. When you get behind closed doors and you're having conversations with people, you can have disagreements, but they're actually pretty reasonable. But I think when people are out in the public domain and they have to be performative, whether it's politicians, whether it's NGOs, you get this kind of screaming. So for me, the challenge is how do you get a space in the middle where it's going to be more tempered conversation and it's going to be complex because you're not towing ideological lines to deal with something that's becoming really quite partisan.
Thank you, Bob. Gillian, maybe if I can pick up on something that Bob said and if you could expand on it. We have seen the bipartisan perspective on sustainability destroyed in recent times, and we really see a kind of polarization. From your perspective, what has been the cause of this polarization in the political landscape?
Well, I'm a great believer in Hegel's view of history, which is that it moves in pendulum swings from one extreme to another, and each phase tends to be a reaction to the former phase. So if you look back in history from the 1980s onwards, we had for 4 or 5 decades the rise of extreme neoliberal free market thinking that was epitomized very much by the idea of Milton Friedman's shareholder first or shareholder only capitalism, which basically argued that companies should only look at shareholders and nothing else when they were setting out their strategies. And at the same time, we had a period of time when not only did free market economists think that the movement of money was so universal and consistent, like gravity, that you could use the laws of physics and equations from physics to predict what would happen to markets, you had a period of seeming quite considerable political stability. And what I think happened was around 2010, after the great financial crisis, first of all, companies began to wake up and realize that there's more to life than the balance sheet, and that shareholder frameworks and macroeconomic frameworks alone don't explain the whole world, and they don't really act as a good guide to risks, because there are lots of risks in politics, culture, the physical environment that tend to be ignored through both economic models and corporate balance sheets. And secondly, around that time, it became very clear in the wake of the great financial crisis that there were mounting political and economic fracture points all around the world. So I think what happened was that companies began to look for ways to manage a wider range of risks. And this coincided with the realization in the environmental and sustainability movement that although they'd been operating in a tiny little niche, which might be called the do-gooding niche, and although they had been developing impact products, there could be more mileage in actually persuading mainstream companies and investors to start looking at this whole world through the lens of risk management. So those two movements came together and gave birth to the acronym ESG. And of course, the other thing that happened was COVID, because what COVID did was show the world that actually ignoring scientific risks, ignoring what people were saying about interconnected dangers on the planet, could be very, very costly. So it wasn't a very difficult idea to move from that to looking at environmental risks, not just pandemic risks. So that all came together to create a boom in ESG from about 2018, 2019. The Business Roundtable wrote a tract on a movement from shareholder-only capitalism or shareholder primacy to stakeholderism in 2019 and changed its mandate, which had a big impact. So this boomed. And then if you're asking what then happened to cause the pendulum swing the other way, I think it's a combination of the rise of the political right that we're looking for, if you like, piñatas or political footballs with which to attack the left. And ESG was a very convenient meme for them to seize on and attack. At the same time, you began to get rising energy costs, particularly after the Ukraine invasion by Russia. And that put a lot of focus on the issues around energy costs and energy pricing. And at the same time, you had a real overreach by parts of the sustainability movement, what Bob calls the sustainability Taliban. And there were elements of the whole framework which did not really stand up to scrutiny, like the idea of putting environmental, social and governance issues into the same bucket, or like the fact that there was confusion between whether you were measuring inputs or outputs, i.e. are you looking at what affects a company or the footprint of a company on the world externally. So there were all those problems that caused this massive backlash to suddenly erupt. And of course, Trump epitomizes all of that in terms of the backlash. The bitter irony, I'll just quickly point this out, two big ironies, is that insofar as the right wing is now regarded as being anti-sustainability, that's very odd because if you look back in history, when the Environmental Protection Agency was first created, it was actually created by Republican President Richard Nixon. And in those days, it was very much seen as a bipartisan issue protecting the landscape. And secondly, insofar as there are surveys of both Republicans and Democrats in America, it seems there are plenty of young Republicans who do care about the environment. And in particular, when sustainability issues are reframed as biodiversity and presented in terms of people protecting their natural heritage, their stewardship of the landscape, those are themes that actually chime quite well with the right, particularly the Christian right. So there's a lot of contradictions around the way it's evolved. But history shows that we have these pendulum swings, but they never stay in one place forever.
So if I could, I'd just like to build on a few points that Gillian made, and I'll do it in reverse order. She's right about you look at young Republicans and you do surveys around climate. There's a group here called the American Conservation Coalition. They've got 85,000 members. They're going to 100,000 members. And it's basically mobilizing millennial conservatives to support Republicans that are running for office that care about climate change. And they're very effective. They're in all 50 states. And two of the states where they're most active are Texas and Florida. These are two of the states where you've got all this anti-ESG legislation and stuff coming out. Gillian's also right. 30 years ago, this climate was not a Democratic versus Republican issue. It was very bipartisan. I think what happened is that the left sort of got the memo first at scale, and then it got wrapped into a bunch of other liberal issues and kind of views that it's big government. And I think you started to lose the right where they didn't necessarily disagree with the issues around climate, but they disagreed with some of the ways it was being framed. And then you also raised the Business Roundtable. I mean, the whole shareholder versus stakeholder capitalism thing is interesting. And it's what you said, Gillian, the inputs and the outputs. And I think companies to some extent brought this on themselves when the wind was at their back and ESG and sustainability was good. They'd wave their hands and they'd go, taking care of stakeholders is good for long-term value creation. Well, yeah, which stakeholders? What are the trade-offs? You can't do everything. You've got limited resources. They'd confound financial and impact materiality in the language of the EU. And they'd have, okay, well, here's what our materiality matrix is. And then they've got the SDG icons. It was like, is this risk management? Are you making the world a better place? And then deep beneath that, I think all of these issues are basically a discussion for what is the role of the corporation in society and company law. Companies haven't always been the way they are. And so the pendulum will swing. But I think this deep question of what do companies do and why do they exist? You've got public benefit corporations where they can have as a public benefit. And you've got these in 39 states in the United States. Little more than half are in red states where a company can be organized on a legal basis to be basically saying it's responsible for producing a positive impact.
You've both talked about some of what's happening on the ground. certainly from what the algorithm served me, I'm being served this kind of, there's action still happening. You referred to some of the innovation already happening on the ground at state level. Do you have a sense of really what's happening on the ground, whether that's at city, regional, sectoral levels? Is there still real momentum towards taking action, whether that's around mitigation or actually adapting to the challenges that are being faced? Or is the politicization actually brought that to a hard stop?
Well, I'd say there are three things going on. Firstly, many of the companies I speak to are just pretty much carrying on as they were before this explosion. And what was greenwashing, in the sense that companies were promising far more than they were actually doing, is now turning to green hushing, which is that companies are still doing stuff, but simply not advertising it. So green hushing is the new mantra of the day. Secondly, one of the reasons that has continued is because outside America, in places like Europe, there's still a number of sustainability frameworks which are essentially out there, which companies need to respect. And for the most part, companies are trying to have a consistent line around the world, for the most part. And many of them suspect that this pendulum swing will not be permanent and they will come back at some point, a new pressure on the sustainability side. And the third point to realize is that in some cases, there are actually good economic reasons why companies would want to be going on a sustainability path. It's partly about risk management, that if you've gone through your supply chains in detail to work out, say, whether you have human rights abuses or environmental abuses in your supply chain, you tend to get a much better sense of how the supply chain is working in the first place. Secondly, if you are adopting clean energy, it's often more cost effective in some areas. I mean, the reason why Texas has so much solar power is because solar power is extraordinarily cheap if you're in a sunny area with good transmission lines. Thirdly, as we go into exploding AI, there's going to be an even bigger need for energy and electrification going forward. And so many companies are thinking, well, it's not necessarily a question of fossil fuels or renewable. We're probably going to need both, and renewable may well have more legs in the future. So for all those reasons, yes, the rhetoric has changed dramatically in the last few years, but I'm not convinced the actual practice has changed as much as it might seem.
Can I just come in there? Would it be true to say that some of the backlash has been self-inflicted by, call it the sustainability community's push to incorporate what I think was eloquently described as virtue creation rather than value creation as an objective for commercial enterprise? And so my question is there a correction to the sustainability efforts of those interested and pursuing such in the commercial world to redirect everything to value creation with an appropriate balance of risk and opportunity, put aside the virtue creating narrative that was so strongly underpinning the ESG reality of the time?
Let me shamelessly pitch a book I'm writing with Professor Shivaram Rajagopal at Columbia Business School that we talked about. I think companies need to take control of the narrative. They're playing defense with attacks on both the left and the right. And the idea is really simple. Look at what's in risk factors. Map those to the material issues for SASB. You will be surprised at the extent to which they show up. So you go and you see, okay, which of these SASB issues are actually reflected in the risk factors? Some are reflected better than others. Then you say, okay, what are the material issues? Let's map those on a line item basis to the income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow statement. And here's where AI is important. It's like a long story. I won't get into the AI weeds. But what it does is it creates really an integrated view between the sustainability people and the financial people who speak different languages and speak to different people. And it's eye-opening, right? Because it forces a degree of analytical rigor that hasn't been there. People have been waving their hands, sustainability, it's good for value creation, making the world a better place. No, these are the things that we think are important. So when someone comes in to talk with me, say, listen, whether they're from the left or the right, thank you for your time. These are what we think the material issues are. Here's how we think they're related to financial performance in terms of line items on the income statement and balance sheet and cash flow statement. Let's have that conversation rather than have it being framed from ESG is woke, ESG isn't saving the world. And we want to get a tool in the public domain to do this. And I think it would change things importantly. but it doesn't necessarily solve the problem that Jillian was talking about is, well, then who should be making the world a better place? And here, I think companies need to, and maybe this is more of a US thing, be clear about what you can do to make the world a better place and where you can't, and where regulation or legislation would be helpful or needed. And then just don't go oppose every regulation and legislation that's being proposed, because if you want to say it's not our job to make the world a better place, we should make it a worse place. Okay, then, you know, what is the role of the public sector? And you need to support policies in the public sector to do so. And, you know, one of my favorites is a price on carbon. I mean, if you could get the corporate community and the investment community, that'll change, that'll move the needle a whole lot more than all these arguments about reporting and scope three and the California law, and the ExxonMobil lawsuit, blah, blah, blah. Let's put a price on carbon.
Well, I would strongly agree with that. It's worth pointing out again that when the movements happened in the 1960s and 70s with Rachel Carson and the so-called Silent Spring movement in America, when they were campaigning to protect the natural wilderness in America, initially, they didn't even bother to talk to companies. They talked to unions and they talked to government officials because they didn't initially assume that it was a company's job to fix this. They thought it was a government's job to fix it. And the fact that the ESG movement was primarily about companies some 50 years later shows how dramatically the framing had shifted.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
I completely agree with the diagnosis of where the action now needs to be. And I know, Gillian, you've kindly come and spoken to our business groups and our investor groups about this, who are themselves thinking about how they can be effective in their public sector engagement and moving from a sense that they should just stay in their lane and keep their head down to see it's in their own interest for there to be an effective market and operating context. How do you square that with your reflection just now on the greenwashing, where people are not speaking up? Are there effective ways in which the private sector is actually able to engage to create an enabling context, or is that just not on the cards at the moment?
I think there are two or three things to think about. The first point to make is that if you're running a company today, you need to keep your workforce and your team around you on board, and you need to show that you really care about the community in every sense. And there are surveys showing that actually employees today tend to look to their own companies as a source of trusted advice and wisdom over and above most of the other sources of trusted wisdom and advice in the past. So doing something to show that you have a real community commitment and awareness is really important and good for you as a leader and good for the company and the bottom line as a whole. Second point to make is that you need to think about stakeholderism, about who are the new stakeholders who are dominating the conversation. And as I said earlier, it's the new compact of ESG in energy pricing, national security issues, and growth. And framing what you're doing on the sustainability front throughout that prism is, in my view, the most effective way to go. You know, you can tell people that actually using solar energy is dramatically cheaper. You can talk about how having energy security and having all manner of ways of upholding the principles of patriotic capitalism is good. And you can also talk about how this is driving growth. So reframing the sustainability debate, I think, is really important. And the third thing is really thinking about language, because unfortunately, the words ESG have become utterly polarizing and they don't really work anymore to build any kind of inclusive movement around sustainability. But using language differently can help a lot. So instead of talking about things like net zero, talking about nature, talking about pollution, talking about being a good steward of the landscape and our shared natural heritage, talking about defending the natural resources and natural riches and beauty of America as part of a patriotic appeal, I think those are the ways to frame it going forward that will be more inclusive and bipartisan.
So I think the language issue is really important. You know, I'm focused on a new narrative for climate change here. We talked about this before. Again, shamelessly pitching a book. This one's actually done. So I wrote a little book, An American's Guide to Climate Change, How America Can Lead and Prosper. Short book. So if you're a climate activist, you're not going to like the book because it's not urgent enough. And if you're a climate change denier, you're not going to like it because the science is real. So it's really happening. We need to do mitigation and adaptation. What a great opportunity for America. We can rise to the occasion. We've had challenges before. we're smarter, we're richer, we're more entrepreneurial, we're more innovative than everybody else in the world, and we can win and we can beat China. And what I do in the book is you've got all these examples, right? It's what we were talking about earlier. So you've got the politicians with their anti-ESG rhetoric. Jillian mentioned Texas. I mean, 30% is coming from renewable energy, and it's mostly wind, and they're growing battery capacity like crazy. So I've got examples in red states and blue states, somewhat different tax depending on the geography, depending on the culture of the place. On the ground, outside of the rhetoric from both extremes, a lot is going on. Now, you still have the problems with this administration, which we can't ignore, but that pendulum will swing. But it swung both ways. But how do we get new language? How do we get a new narrative that's going to appeal to most everybody else, which is like 80 to 90% of the population?
I mean, tragically, because there's now such a backlash against efforts for mitigation, we are going to see the climate and the planet warm. That just is a scientific prognosis. And so questions about adaptation are going to become increasingly important. And that's an area where any entrepreneur can definitely have the glimmer of an opportunity, and where many companies can have a glimmer of opportunity in adaptation measures, but also where their employees and voters in general want to know, what are we going to do about floods in Texas, devastating floods in Texas, or rising sea levels in Miami, or funky, weird wildfires in places like Colorado or Los Angeles? How are we going to respond? And that's an area where both companies can show leadership by talking about it directly, but also of extraordinarily good entrepreneurial opportunity.
I think you're right. And I just put a little plug for the EcoRide. I mentioned them before. So, you know, fairly young. These are conservatives focused on climate change. The ACC is one example. They take climate change seriously. They really do, right? But when I first started engaging with these folks, what was fascinating to me, we didn't talk about climate transition plans and net zero and scope 1, 2, and 3 reporting. In some ways, it was much more pragmatic. You got to fix the grid in the United States. The grid's a mess. You need to perform the permitting process because we've got 2,600 gigawatts of renewable energy. We can't get into the grid because you can't get the permits, and focus on technologies that are not just renewable. Bond of nuclear, IM2, small modular reactors, geothermal. So the left has had this finance-centric theory of change, and I think that's not worked out very well with the GFANs and Climate Action 100 Plus. I think all well-intended. I think having the right tends to be more technology-focused. You clearly need both. And what I'm finding in its early stages as I try and mediate these kind of different groups, I find that the eco-right is more than happy to engage with center-left organizations on climate, but that's not necessarily reciprocated. Because they're Republicans. Well, just because they're Republicans doesn't mean you shouldn't talk to them. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I talk to Republicans. I haven't died yet. It's fine.
So in order to nudge the pendulum to swing back, I've heard a focus on language, that there's common ground around nature, that potentially adaptation as a starting point, and that it's going to need that combination of both finance and tech, and not either or. But I'm interested in, I call them the missing middle. I think, Bob, you referred to the exhausted middle, people who are just frustrated with how polarized it has been, and as you say, just want to get on. What will it take to re-engage them? People who've basically just checked out. Do you think there's latent appetite to engage? I'm interested in practically what will it take to re-engage them if that's needed?
I mean, it's a good question that I don't have an answer to. I'm trying to figure that out with my book a little bit, because when you look at surveys in America, 75% of Republicans and 80% of Democrats, it's like really close, are frustrated with how polarized the discussion about climate has been. They want an alternative. At the same time, even for Democrats, it's not in the top five for the man and woman in the street. I think this kind of narrative doomsday hasn't been appealing to people. And that's, again, what's been dominating things a lot. How you get to people whose lives aren't lived around sustainability and ESG, it's a really hard question that I don't have the answer to. How you get a narrative that's appealing to everyday folk who've got a lot of other things on their mind than climate change and sustainability? I don't know.
I think there are three tactics you can use. The first is to tug on the heartstrings and put up pictures of cute pandas and dying seals and talk about the horrors of biodiversity loss. That tends to work quite well. And that works well amongst conservative establishment people, often not just Democrats. The second thing you can do is talk about adaptation and talk about the need to find solutions to wildfires in Los Angeles or rising sea levels in Miami, to talk about the need to create barricades, but really to tap into people's very direct personal experience of the cost and impact of climate change. And the third thing you can do is try and talk to people's wallets. And if you can find a way to tell them that this is going to be cheaper energy that happens to be renewable as well, that may work too.
Who is best placed to join up the left and the right? Who should be, could be in a position to help create the kind of narratives that you just outlined that would integrate this polarity?
I would argue it's a combination of sports stars talking about it. I would look to big historian, environmental figures, people who are able to command some gravitas but not seen as being too politicized above all else. And then company leaders.
So I'm keen to shift the lens outside of the US domestic context and to look at what are the consequences of US polarization, the current US administration's position on the rest of the world. What's the material impact or likelihood of the US position going to be on global efforts to tackle systemic issues? We've just seen a COP with no US presence. We've just seen a G20 with no US presence, managed to get to not the ambitions that many involved might have hoped, but some quite pragmatic implementation-focused action and emergence of what's being termed coalitions of the willing. I'm interested in whether you think the US is going to slow global action or simply count itself out and progress will continue without them.
Well, the bitter irony of what's happened in the last few years is that we used to think that climate change would be an area which would encourage more global collaboration. And it's actually ended up being an area of geostrategic competition, not collaboration, because China has so successfully and frankly so wisely come to dominate the green manufacturing supply chain. So one of the things that poisons this all the way through the green debate right now is a perception in parts of the West that there's a choice between going green or cutting yourself off from dependency on China. And that's a real challenge for Europe right now. At the moment, Europe is caught between trying to stick to its vision and goals and its sense of ethics, which many European leaders want to do, but at the same time realizing that they can't afford to be essentially dominated by America because American companies have cheaper subsidized energy costs rather than European companies, or making themselves vulnerable to the Chinese supply chain. So you are seeing some rowing back and watering down of sustainability moves. You're seeing that in parts of Asia as well. But you're seeing, more importantly, a rather anxious debate amongst European companies and policymakers about how exactly they are going to compete with America going forward if they're both playing by different rules. I think one other thing that's happened quite unexpectedly is that the AI boom and the dash to create data centers is, again, underscoring the need for more energy. And yes, in the short term, that's creating a bump in fossil fuel outputs. However, most of the big tech companies are keenly aware of the need to develop carbon-free energy sources simply because they want all the energy they can for as long as they can in the most sustainable way they can. And sustainable means basically pursuing a range of options, but including renewable energy in particular. I can't stress strongly enough the need to recast a lot of the debate into environmental protection and landscapes and natures. And it's worth pointing out that the first Trump administration was wildly enthusiastic about tree planting. And they actually teamed up with Mark Benioff to create originally what was called a 1 trillion tree campaign and then a 2 trillion tree campaign to try and create lots more trees. And that's something which is very useful as a bipartisan tool because it's very hard to hate on trees, a bit like apple pie and motherhood. So finding the equivalent of trees planting in all different ways is maybe a way to recast the debate.
I guess the only thing I'd emphasize is that become, particularly in the United States, has become so tribal. Like, just give other people the benefit of the doubt. If you're a Democrat, don't just write off Republicans because they're Republicans. You may not agree with them on a bunch of things, but you can be friends with them. If you're a Republican, you can be friends with Democrats. But what we're focused on is the things that we find agreement on to try and get bipartisan solutions. So just getting people to change their mental attitude about the other would be really helpful.
Thank you. And just to close out, I'd love to hear any words of advice that you have for today's business leaders or today's investors who are deeply concerned about the future direction of economies, who want to lean in to be part of building something better, but are genuinely struggling to navigate this moment. We've heard about language, about stepping outside of today's tribalism. We've talked about lobbying for specific government interventions, for example, carbon price. Is there anything more that you would add, any other advice that you would give to today's leaders who are genuinely looking at this and I'm not quite sure what will work?
I would say very briefly to remember that the roots of the word company, if you're running one, come not from anything to do with balance sheets or spreadsheets or profits. It comes from the old Italian con panio, which means with bread. And that's because the original companies were literally groups of people who came together and ate. And that means your staff canteen is incredibly important, not just symbolically, but it also indicates what's going on in a company, which is about people interacting with each other and with the world around them. And when you start reframing it that way, you start to realize that, of course, it's natural that we think about stakeholders. Yes, the stakeholders that are top of the agenda right now might be shifting, but taking a holistic view of a company's actions and how they operate is very important. That's how good companies actually behave. And when people were justifying the early years of the ESG movement, they said it's because the ESG investing would help the bottom line, or ESG activity would help a company's bottom line. The reality is it doesn't always in the short term, but in the long term, building a sustainable, holistic community of people who are aware of the world they're operating in, want to keep that world a pleasant place, and want to make sure that they collectively uphold a sense of shared purpose is really important.
So I agree with what Gillian said. I like her kind of broad and historical perspective. Let me frame it at a very kind of micro level. And I'll invoke the novel Animal Farm, where all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And in companies, the more equal animal is the CFO compared to the CSO. And on the investor side, it's the portfolio manager compared to the ESG and proxy voting team. I think you need much tighter integration on the company side between the CFO and the CSO, and on the investor side, Mark, between the portfolio managers and the ESG team, whatever they're called, so that essentially a CFO would be able to talk about sustainability in financial terms and vice versa for the CSO. And what you'd say, the same thing on the asset management side, because until you can get both the CSO and the CFO with a common narrative and view of the company, and the same thing on the investor side in terms of how they think about material ESG issues and sustainability issues, I think you're going to just continue to have this bifurcated conversation that confounds value and virtues, the inputs and the outputs. And that's something that's under the control of companies. CSOs need to know financial talk, and CFOs need to know sustainability talk, and it needs to be the same talk. What you see happening in companies, it's moving in that direction. You've got very different kind of people going into the sustainability function than you had before. And I think the changes are even bigger in some ways, Mark, on the investor side. So that'd be my take on that.
Thank you both so much for joining us. It's been really helpful to take that long view and understand the probably inevitable pendulum swing. And I agree with your analysis, Gillian, that ESG was always problematic and that it's really important that we stop conflating value and virtues, but we do need to make sure that we parse things out properly and all get on the same page. And reassuring to hear, Bob, that you think that we are actually making progress on that front. It's also been really helpful to get a reminder that although politics may be polarized and tribal, at a human level, communities have very much in common. There's a lot of common ground around nature, around adaptation, about wanting to build better. And I love your line, Gillian, about where we can start, that no one hates on trees. Thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to What Next? Leadership Conversations for a Better Future.
This show is presented by Lindsay Hooper, Chief Executive of CISL, and Mark Kahn, Investec's Chief Strategy and Sustainability Officer. The producers are Carl Homer of Cambridge TV and Alexa Selwood. The executive producer is Gillian Secret, and it's produced in partnership with Investec. Thank you for listening. For more episodes, subscribe on any major podcast platform or visit the Leadership Hub on the CISL website or Investec Focus. You'll find the address in the show notes.